No children's books, no TV chair.
You're continuing the theme from last week's show. But so my childhood was what? It was one green chair for the living room.
It was the Massachusetts gulag, as far as we're concerned.
This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am Mark Oppenheimer, but in France, je suis Mark Oppenheimer. Joined as ever by my co-hosts, Tablet senior writer Liel Leibovitz.
In Israel, I'm Mamatzav Liel Leibovitz.
And Tablet deputy editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hi.
Who on Long Island is Stephanie Butnick.
No, I'm, well, my alter ego is Stefani, S-T-E-F-A-N-I.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's my Sasha Fierce.
Today, we bring you a buffet of conversations about Yiddish theater, punk rock, and teen life. First, we speak with comedy legend Jackie Hoffman, a star of the Yiddish Fiddler on the Roof, and with the Yiddish language consultant to their cast, Motel Didner. Also, Stephanie spoke with Australian novelist Bram Presser about his book, The Book of Dirt, which is a great title.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
such a good book.
Should have been The Book of Schmutz, but okay.
That's so Ashkenormative of you.
It is.
One of my kids got so mad at me recently when I said, oh, it was Anna. I said, there's some schmutz on your face. She's like, Daddy, I don't have schmutz. I was like, well, it just means dirt. She's like, fine, tell me I have dirt on my face. But schmutz seemed, it offended her dignity so much that I
also, said, schmutz is such like a dad word.
It is.
It is. I don't think it was ever used on me. I don't know where I got it from. I have one thing I want to bring to the table today, which is I was in Starbucks and I saw this really tall guy and I had this sort of well of, I'm not going to say rage, but annoyance rose up in me.
But
it was
kind of
a tall guy, and I'm not going to say rage.
What was his order?
So I don't even know. He was standing around in that way. Some people stand around at Starbucks like they're waiting for something.
Like in a tall way?
In a tall.
Like their coffee.
They're like in your business sort of tall way. But no, I want to. I'm not doing a bit here. I'm being sincere. The bit is actually a sincere bit, which is sometimes, but I know it's kind of stupid. I'm aware of that. And the feeling, the voice in my head goes, oh, come on. Who are you kidding? Like who, what, you think you could be, I mean, by the way, I mean people like over 6'5". This guy was like 6'6 or 6'7".
You thought he was just taunting you just with his tallness.
But see, the thing is, I don't have insecurity about being short.
How tall are you?
I'm a little under 5'8". I'm like 5'7 three quarters. And I'm shrinking. I think I'm now 5'7 and a half. But I peaked at 5'7 three quarters. Also, it's different at the end of the day because you squish, gravity pulls you down.
Really?
But in the morning, I'm almost 5'8".
Is that because you measure yourself like on the wall?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I take out the pen. I wake up, sit. I'm like, I'm at
it's
my
not
tallest.
The kids. It's all like, Mark, age 41. Mark, age 42.
Okay. So the feeling is just like, I'll see him and I just want to do this bit or I want to walk up to be like, oh, who do you think you are being 6'7"? Like, what the fuck is up with that?
So you're saying you don't have it like any complex?
It doesn't feel like a complex. It just feels like, because I don't feel it with people who are 6'1 or 6'2, which is a height I might actually enjoy being. There's no part of me that wants to be 6'7".
What about my 6'5"? Is that a little bit?
Your 6'5" is like cute. 6'5" is like a little bit, it's a little silly.
But also, Liel,
that's as much as you will take from us tall people.
Do you guys know what I mean though? When you say it was 6'7", you're like, oh, come on.
But I think that
that's
like,
a bit
excessive.
It's a bit detached.
No, needs to be this tall.
I think that's being really tough on someone for whom life is probably a little bit difficult. Like, think about those airline seats. Like, everything is hard when you're over 6'5".
Yes. And I had a very.
Everything is so hard.
No.
Well, so I had a conversation with a
women don't find you attractive.
No, at a certain point you might be,
you
like,
can never reach the top shelf in the supermarket.
No, I think there's like a past the ideal height, you know what I mean? And things are hard. Like your limbs, where do you put them? Buying clothing is difficult. Like I think
you're 6'5"?
I'm 6'5".
Speaking of people who move through the world, that's a stupid segue. A little news of the Jews.
Speaking of taking up space.
That's good. Speaking of taking up space.
In the Jewish community. This is the craziest. This is the craziest story.
Tell us the story out of Chicago, Stephanie.
Okay. This is from JTA.
Mr. Cohen.
I know. This is amazing. Josephine Dolston, who is a very great reporter for JTA. Basically, this couple in Chicago became part of the Jewish community. They attended an Orthodox synagogue.
Now, you're looking at a photo of them right now. Describe what they look like.
Basically, you know, she covers her hair. He has the side locks. Side locks anti-Semitic?
No.
No.
He has the pay. You know, she has skirts. Like, she actually even gets the style with, like, a shirt with another shirt over, like a button down. Like, she has.
You see them in the street, you're like, these are frummy,
you're like, unorthodox in the streets. But actually, what they ended up in the sheets is they are Christian missionaries.
Oh.
And it turns out they have been sort of, like, gone undercover in the Orthodox Jewish community of Chicago. And then once you get to know them, they start telling you about Yeshua.
Jesus, yeah, right? Yeshua, Jesus, the Mashiach. Yeah. Yeah.
And people, and they said, we actually keep the Torah and the mitzvahs. We actually have an Orthodox life in our house and every day of our life. Basically, they function as religious Jews, but they believe in Jesus. And
they're Jews for Jesus.
And they're Messianic. Yeah.
So I have to tell you,
yeah,
you know how I feel about Jews for Jesus. My feeling is, you know, well-known and contemptuous. But I have a little bit of respect for this particular couple.
Because they're so all in.
They are playing the game on hard. They're like, we're not just going to go to, like, random Jews at a Hillel. We're going to go in the Orthodox community. We're going to throw down in Shabbat, be like, yeah, Jesus, bitch.
Right. I mean, now, to be fair, so we don't get the angry mail, Jews for Jesus is one denomination of Messianic Jews. So not all Messianic Jews are Jews for Jesus affiliated. But yeah, they're basic. Well, they're not so different from other Messianic Jews. They're just the Orthodox version. Like, normally you encounter Reform and conservative Messianic Jews. And these guys are like the full Shomer Shabbos, you know.
These guys are the Satmars of the Messianic Jews.
There is something about the sort of hardcoreness of it that I can imagine would.
Well, they go by David and Rivka. And it's like, here's the crazy thing. It's kind of like how we were talking
David
about the other week, like how anti-Semites know so much about Jews.
Yeah.
Like, actually, the Christian missionaries are like, I'm not going to get found out by, right, you know, by not knowing how to, what was the spies of no country? Like,
yeah,
like they know everything,
yeah,
that they need to do. And they're living Jewish lives. And you're like, wow.
But dude, just sell your product. Like, why go through all the show? You'd be like, you know, it was great, Jesus. You want some Jesus?
Yeah.
I got some Jesus right here.
Because here's the thing, like, so my friend Alan Appel, he wrote this great novel, The Book of Norman, and in which
Norman.
And in which he the main character is Jewish and becomes Mormon because they're living in Southern California. It's the late 60s, early 70s. He's sort of disaffected with Judaism and the Jewish counterculture. And he meets these incredibly non-countercultural, clean-cut Mormons who hang out on a beach, play volleyball with like really cute women and grill meat. And he's like, oh my God, I want to lead a beach lifestyle. And he becomes Mormon because what they're selling is neurosis-free, you know,
oh my
food
God.
With bacon. And he's like, that's better than what I've got at home with Bubby.
This is what it's these, like, guys are not getting.
Yeah. Like,
get Jesus. Be like, do you want no neurosis? Like, yes, please.
Yeah.
Come over here.
The funniest thing is that, like, people, I think, were tipped off when they got Purim baskets, Mishloach Manot, but they contained missionary materials.
Oh, is that how they got outed?
And they say this wasn't them. They didn't do it. But basically, people were like, there are things that were off. In this article, it says, like, the woman dressed modestly, but didn't wear, like, darker color. Like, didn't, like, and her Hebrew, you know, she had pronounced Yiddish words a little bit weird. And he had, like, great Bible knowledge, but didn't speak very good Hebrew.
Yeah.
And so, like, there were, like, these weird
Instead
things
of
that.
Chai, they said Christ.
They are, however, better Jews than the people at Harvard who published
True.
A sexualized photo of Anne Frank. The Harvard Lampoon did this sort of jokey thing about – the headline is so Harvard Lampoon's a humor magazine at Harvard. The headline is, gone before her time, virtual aging technology shows us what Anne Frank would have looked like if she hadn't died. And it's a picture of Anne Frank superimposed on a super busty, like, triple D cup porn body. And they got in lots of stuff for this. There was a petition circulating that the magazine be held accountable. The Harvard Hillel rabbi, Jonah Steinberg, wrote to the Lampoon editors, and he said this recalls Nazi propaganda. And I'm not easily offended. I always have this disclaimer. I think a lot of stuff is funny. We, of course, are perhaps the country's leading purveyor of Holocaust jokes. So we –
Not Holocaust. Like, there's a difference. Okay,
right.
First of all, I have a few. It's just a cheap shot. It was like Anne Frank on like a pin as a pinup.
Yeah, it's an affront to humor. Forget
Jews.
So
it's not funny. Yeah. So that's actually a big deal. It wasn't like and you know what actually would be funny is like some subversive commentary on the fact that like Anne Frank has become such a global symbol that actually you could argue that. You know what I mean? Like, she's become such a trope that maybe there is some really, like, subversive thing you could do with that. But, like, putting her on a, like, big boob swimsuit model is not
right. –
doesn't
she's
feel
been,
right.
She's been so marketed that, like, you wouldn't be surprised if there was, like, Anne Frank-themed Oreos around, you know, Holocaust Remembrance Day or something. That, like, there's a way in which you could mock
like
how
that,
commercialized she's been. Mm-hmm. But it's not put her over enormous boobs with a really skinny
to me,
washboard.
That's like,
the tagline would be, so good you want to hide them.
But to me,
there we go. You're welcome.
Thank you, Lampoon.
Nabisco.
But so it to me is like, oh, it shows how like people think Holocaust is edgy. Like there's a way in which it's like an easy trope to go to, being like, oh, we're gonna make. And I imagine a lot of them are Jewish. Right. And the problem is,
I actually imagine a lot of them aren't Jewish because there are fewer and fewer Jews in the Ivy League these days.
Harvard is less than 6% nowadays. Plus, I'm sorry, but in that
6 million percent
stupid fucking campus, like I bet they would not have poked fun at any other ethnicity because, oh my God, we'll be so offended.
It is hard to imagine them taking a African American figure, an Asian American figure,
that just
and doing
fired
that.
A member of the law faculty for agreeing to represent Harvey Weinstein. All right, like, all right. This is a really dumb campus.
Well, wait, the dumbest campus in America.
No, they're not.
That goes to my wife's alma mater, Williams College, where the sort of like student activities, the STUACs, Student Senate. Government, whatever, which is a dumb activity. By the way, I'm going to begin my memo to college undergrads. If you're spending your time in student government,
you're doing it wrong.
You've already failed college.
Completely.
You've already completely misused college.
Totally wrong.
But they denied funding, having not
denied
funding.
What's wrong with you for belonging to clubs?
Having denied funding to no student group basically ever, they denied funding to a group that wanted to do kind of Israel education that was not some sort of like, you know, far right group. It was a group that said, we want to bring people to speak from the left, from the right, but it's going to be about
Literally,
Israel.
The group acronym is Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. Williams Initiative for Israel.
Which right there, you should give them money because that's awesome.
So Tablet ran a piece about this by this great professor named Casey Johnson. And he actually wanted to talk to some of these students at Williams. And one of them said the following thing. And I'm quoting almost verbatim here. He's like, well, I actually think this isn't one of these meetings in which Wi-Fi was banned, in which there was no Wi-Fi reception.
It's a dead zone.
Or as your grandma says, Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi. One of these students, this is Williams, one of the country's best colleges. He said, well, you know, I actually think that what Israel is doing is worse than what the Nazis did, because the Nazis put the Jews in ghettos for really short periods of time, and the Israelis put the Palestinians in ghettos for really long periods of time, so it's worse. Now, here's the thing. Forget the Israel thing. Forget the Jew. Forget all the politicized shit around this, right? For a person, for a student in one of this country's elite institutions to display absolutely zero sense of historical knowledge, what is this degree even worth at
That's
this
amazing.
Point? Like,
they
this
only had to stay in the Warsaw Ghetto a couple years before they got shipped out, before they were given tickets
and honestly,
to
the
East.
They were only in Auschwitz for a short amount of time, too.
They were, sometimes minutes.
Sometimes minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
That's not bad, right?
I think there's a, that's truly disturbing. And for someone to like feel so confident of their viewpoint to share that with someone, you're like, why would you ever?
Right.
This is wrong.
And be popular for it.
Yeah. I would love to hear from Williams students or alumni about
go to professional schools.
Going on.
Go to culinary schools.
By the way, I think you're wrong about that. I've been thinking about your latest
My call
project
tablet
in
for
the
Jews
world.
Not to go to universities
well,
or fund them.
For your basically, don't go to college.
Don't go to college.
And I think that's wrong. I have some sympathy for it, but
well, that's boys go to Jupiter to get that.
Rebecca Minkoff, are you listening?
That's for another show. That's for another show. We got some live shows to talk about. June 26th, we'll be in Chicago with Blair Braverman, a Jewess who competed in the Iditarod race in Alaska. Go to bit.ly/unorthodoxchicago. May 30th, that is tonight for many of you listening. Come see me at Hebrew College in Boston, hebrewcollege.edu for more information on that. And still time to sign up for Thread at Yale, thread.yale.edu. You can learn storytelling with me, Catherine Burns from The Moth, and others.
We are here with the legendary Jackie Hoffman, actress, singer, stand-up comedian. She plays Yenta the Matchmaker in the National Yiddish Theater's production of Fiddler on the Roof, currently playing at Stage 42. We are also here with Muttel Didner, the associate director of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne. He is a Yiddishist, director, and performer. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is an all-Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof. A lot of our listeners have already seen it. A lot of our listeners want to see it.
A lot of our hosts have seen it.
A lot of our hosts have seen it. A lot of our hosts love it.
Yep.
Jackie, did you have to learn Yiddish for this role?
I had to learn my lines for the role in Yiddish. So I had to learn a limited portion of Yiddish for the role. Although when it comes to ad-libbing, hubbubbing, and background in scenes, I'm sorry, I don't know the language.
So did you have any Yiddish sort of in your arsenal before this?
I did. I had a word here and there, what my mother notoriously labels kitchen Yiddish. So it was part of my, like Muttel says, part of my neshoma.
And then when you were learning the lines for this, how much attention were you paying to what they meant in English at the time?
surprisingly more than I pay attention to what they mean when I learn lines in English. There's like a couple of methods to learn when you just put the words together like nonsensical syllables and don't address meaning to them and learn the meaning later. But I found it much more helpful if I learned the meaning of what I was saying immediately.
So now, does that mess with your process? Because I'm a huge fan. I've seen you in pretty much everything. And I remember, for example, saw you recently in On the Town and felt like so amazed by how like totally and completely you sort of embodied that character and like the entire stage seemed to be yours. Like when you have to stop for a second and actually think about the meaning of what it is that you're saying, does that kind of create a kind of barrier in your process? Is
it gets
different-
more comfortable. Like now that we've been doing it so long, I thought as we've been doing this so long, I didn't think it would change, but it really has evolved and I've gotten a lot finally really settling into it and being able to take more chances and take over more because I'm more comfortable with the language. But there's still, as the gentleman next to me, like the piano teacher who slaps your hands with a ruler, like that's always in the back of my mind. And sometimes a syllable will be off and it'll fly out. We're like, damn it. Didn't mean to do that. I know what the right way was.
He'd be like, it's pronounced oi.
Right. You're just concentrating on two levels because you're concentrating on the meaning and the intent of what you're saying, but also to get those perfect, beautiful, guttural, crude sounds.
It just occurred to me that you must have the most insane people waiting at the stage door for you, and they must have all sorts of opinions about what you got right and what you got wrong.
Yeah, we like to think so. Nobody waits at the stage door. It's you know, we're in a Port Authority tunnel.
So how do you hear
sometimes some crazy broad, you know, will be there, you know, someone who you know has an apartment on the Upper West Side with 8 rooms that she pays $300 for, that type.
One but room for each
it
cat.
It was more, you know, it was more rowdy when we were at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. And because it's not a real theater, we had to walk through the front lobby to get out the front door.
I like that.
And so that was like, I'm grabbing you and pawing you, and I have no respect for you right now. You know, there was a lot of that.
So we actually spoke to Rachel Zatkoff and James Monroe Stevko, and they talked to us a little bit about how they had to learn Yiddish. And I was wondering, Mutchel, if you could give us a sense of what it is like to actually learn Yiddish. What you sort of have to teach the actors.
Yeah, teach us something.
Sure. Well, in terms of how we teach the actors, we give them a transliterated script because of
course. We want you to be as cruel to us as you are to them.
Yeah.
As merciless.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the starting point is we have to take the script kind of apart because it's written in Hebrew letters from right to left, and we have to assume that most of our actors can't read that. So we have to provide a transliteration.
Cretans.
Yes.
Not knowing Hebrew right to left.
I knew it.
Jews these days.
Yeah.
So you have this transliteration system that, you know, KH is and EY is A and AY is I. And so you have to kind of like learn that as well. So we break it down for them. We give them recordings that they kind of drill and drill and drill. We do this even as far back as the preparing for auditions go. And we're looking for people with really good ear who can mimic it very well. We start coaching with them beforehand, and we try to be very exacting. And the lady to my right points out that, yeah, if a syllable is off, if the stress is on the wrong syllable, we gotta, you know, stop them and have them say it over again and over and over
until it's do that to us.
Yeah. So let's start with
Flecht.
We're gonna go right into advanced Yiddish.
Good.
So
they're good.
Not
a little German. German.
Oh, sorry. I know German, there. so that's my problem.
But we're going to get to that soon. Yeah, we're going to go into the advanced level.
I know the master's
worst
language.
Case
because
scenario.
Yeah. The thing is, when you're learning Yiddish, you have to learn the culture as well as the language. Otherwise, it's, you know, it is too similar to German.
You have to be just 30% more complainy than you are normally.
That's right. Yeah. So we're going to start with a very complex question in
Yiddish.
I'm
also German-Jewish, so like my allergy to Yiddish is generations old. Like I probably, there's no hope for me, right?
So in Yiddish, one of the most difficult questions you can ask someone is, how are you, right? In English, it's a very simple answer. How are you? Fine, thanks. How are you? And you know, there's some insufferably cheerful people who will tell you just how happy they are.
Amazing.
And the people who are more kvetchy in English, we don't really want to hear from them.
So have a blessed day.
Shut them down. But in Yiddish, we have to, so there's two ways to ask. There's vos machst du, which is literally what do you make? And you can also say vos Herzich. So, was Herzich? What have you heard? What's the news?
Oh, I like that one.
So, let me hear you. Was machst du?
Was machst du?
Good. And was Herzich?
Was Herzich?
Good. Very good. Now, the very simplest answer is gut.
Gut.
Right. Not gut, but nein. Gut. it's the as in
give it to me
book.
Again. Give it to me.
Gut.
Gut.
Uh-huh. Gut. But you never want to say that because there you're tempting the evil eye.
Right. Oh.
So you have to cancel out immediately with a kinahara.
Kinahara.
Or a tu-tu-tu. You got to spit on the floor a little bit.
Tu-tu-tu.
I don't mean to interrupt here. Did people really do that, or did Mike Myers just insert that into the culture? I have a lot of old relatives, and some of them are the Yiddish side of the family. Never heard anyone say tu-tu-tu.
Oh, or poo-poo.
Or poo-poo-poo.
Oh, I get it all.
Once again, Mark.
That's not
the
just
Oppenheimers.
That's just not SNL shtick. People say poo-poo-poo.
No, that is very, that's my grandmother. Very real.
I'm from Kinahara people.
Yeah. All right.
So you can always answer with an oi.
Oy.
Which is about as clear as day. People know what you mean when you say that. Now, you can also get into the sarcastic, which is also about as Yiddishy as it gets. So, was machst du, right, is the question, what are you making? Kein bris mach ich nicht. I'm not making a bris. Right.
So, like, there's
but
nothing
for me,
happy.
That would be a really good
right.
thing.
Yeah.
You can say
Bol
that.
Bol Hashem,
Jackie's
not Hashem, making a bris.
Baruch Hashem, I'm not making a bris.
And then, to me, what's the most Yiddish answer that could possibly be, was herzich, or was machst du? Was soll sich hören? What should I hear? How should I be?
Was soll sich hören?
Yeah, was soll ich hören?
Was soll ich hören?
Was soll ich hören?
Good, but hören.
Hören.
Yeah.
Okay.
The R is a little, you know, not so
there
German.
Yet. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Then you can just plunge into the straight up dramatic. How are you? Asa yoraf meine sonim. My enemies should have a year like mine.
I want to get back to the show for a second. So when we had your cast mates early on, the show was this kind of, you know, really interesting phenomenon. It just started and people were really excited it was happening. And, you know, hey, it seemed like a cool idea for something to do for a short while. It seemed like now it's become something much, much, much bigger than that. It's this kind of huge show that people are so excited about. It you know, moved to a new venue. It is going on in time. Does that kind of change the way that you play the characters? Have you kind of grown into them? Has your understanding of the character develop with time? Or is it just
like I said, it's like in any long run, is that I've become more comfortable with the character. And I, you know, you can make new discoveries on stage. Mostly motivated out of, oh my God, if I don't do something different right now. But, you know, it gets deeper and deeper. It doesn't really alter, you know, she's still what she is. You know, everybody still stays very true to their characters, but people are finding new things and it's getting like deeper and even more intense, I feel.
Did you feel that you had to fight against stereotype? People have an idea of what Yenta is and what a Yenta is, and how do you create individuality out of people's expectations?
Right,
that?
There's actually one bizarre scene and song in the show where she acts like completely abandons everything I'm doing and acts like a real Yenta and a gossip and creates gossip and wants to know gossip, which is much more how I am in real life. But I think the language helps take out the language for me, stripped any campiness and any phoniness and shticklich out of this script. Because, you know, nitazoi zichazoi to me is a lot more authentic than right, of course, right. You know, like now that sounds completely vulgar and campy to me, that whole, oi, my head should fall in the mud, you know, and this just makes it's so incredibly unhip that it's become the hippest thing ever.
Jackie, did you like the play Fiddler on the Roof, the musical Fiddler on the Roof?
I had an obligatory love for it. I mean, I always thought it was a little cornball, but I always loved it and loved the music. And it was like, you know, when black people saw Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek. Oh, look, there's a black person right. on the Bridge of the Enterprise. It was like, there's a Jewish musical.
But I think
that kind of pride.
What you said is so true. The fact that in Yiddish, it is stripped of all its camp. It's almost like it's so raw and real. And there's a way in which I think
I'm nodding.
Yeah, just nodding emphatically. There's a way in which I know you always steal the show, but in this particular show, it's all Yenta is like, it's all Yenta. And I think it's because of the Yiddish, and it's you speaking, it's seeing Jackie Hoffman speaking Yiddish. It's just so amazing, I think.
Such a relief.
Do you get a lot of fans of your TV? Like, are Difficult People fans showing up?
I hope so. One night, because my first moment in the show is when I try to set up a girl with a guy's son, and her name is Rochel, which was my character's name. So one night I said Rochel, and you hear from the audience, Rochel! But normally, I don't know. I don't think so. I hope so.
What's your favorite role you've ever played?
Oh, God, that's so tough. I mean, Rochel is up there. Madame Dilly from On the Town is up there. I've been very lucky. Kinahara.
Can you do some of your lines? Like when you come out in that.
In you gotta that pay to see
it. I'm not gonna do my fucking lines.
But there's when you're like,
offer me water or coffee.
That's true. Whose job was that?
Yeah.
Where's our
Who
assistant?
Are you pointing at?
Yeah, it's too late.
Our producer Josh is like, it's not my job. It's some
Don't
other producer's
backpedal.
Job.
You could make up for that by not asking me to do my fucking lines. Let's learn more Yiddish, Muckle.
Fregnisht. Don't ask.
What's that? Me don't ask. Fregnisht.
So it's curious because this show is obviously not just popular with Jews, right? Especially
I
now.
Hope not.
You've run out of Jews.
You've run out
to
of
buy
Jews.
Tickets.
They've all seen
you
it.
Do you know how I knew this? That there's non-Jews who are coming because we had a show on Ash Wednesday and I saw with the schmutz on the forehead.
With the schmutz on the forehead.
I said, oh, there's non-Jews coming.
How ironic. Now the non-Jews have to wear visible marks.
It's so true. I was walking around my town on Ash Wednesday. There is that thing where like it's the day they come out of the closet as Catholics. People you didn't know ever went to church all of a sudden have.
Right, my first instinct is say, so you have a little schmutz. I want to lick my thumb like my mother.
Right.
Clean it off.
Let me just get that for you.
You should have special like discounts for, you know, parish night at the, St. Aidan and St. Brendan's parish. At the Volksbühne.
Maybe we should. That would be cool to invite church groups and not just shul groups and stuff. We had on Shabbos, we had a group of 100 black school students from like a charter school in Harlem who had just done a production of Fiddler, which I would have killed to see.
Amazing.
And they came out of the Port Authority and the Papas, woo! I mean, they're singing the whole score. They knew the whole show, so they didn't even have to barely look at the subtitles.
How did, as the world's leading Jewish podcast, how did we miss that there was like a black school in Harlem doing Fiddler? We shouldn't be surprised since everyone's done Fiddler. You know, when we get an actor on our show, on our podcast, doesn't matter how Goyesha, like you say, what was one of your early parts? Fiddler on the Roof. They've all
Everybody
done it.
But me.
Really? You never
That's
did
my
it?
First Fiddler ever, ever.
Your high school didn't have the annual Fiddler on the Roof production?
Like the shul had it, the high school had it, everybody had it. I never made it.
You were waiting
for the
Mama
Lotion. Best one.
So will you tell us a little bit about the Volksbühne?
Absolutely.
If I'm saying it correctly?
You are saying it perfectly.
What does it mean? What's a Bühne?
So Bühne means stage.
Oh, people's stage.
The people's stage.
Okay,
yeah, we've
go.
Been around since 1915. We've never missed a season. And we produce classics of the Yiddish stage as well as developing new works. We did the obviously Fiddler is the U.S. premiere. It's not we didn't commission it. It was actually done in Israel in 65, only a year after Fiddler hit Broadway. But
did you always know about it?
We always knew about it. We always knew that it existed. And it was always, you know, it's funny because I've been with a company for 16 years and, you know, people are very free with their advice. You know what you should do? You should do Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish. And well, a kind of, you know, a no-brainer.
Thankfully you listened.
But you can never get the rights to it. I think not only are we the first Yiddish production in America, we're the first time that it's ever been done in New York that's not a Broadway production. Because you can't get the rights to it, right? There's always somebody planning the next revival. There's always somebody sitting on the options. And we just hit that magic moment where the previous Broadway
which was a good
production.
Between legitimate fiddlers.
It closed about a year before we approached them. And the next production, which is, I guess probably the one that's in the West End now, hasn't come to New York yet. And we got in there.
What were you before you were Muttal?
Oh, my right. It's funny because
what was your
usually,
name?
Right. My English name is Matthew.
Matthew.
Yeah. And but you, my Hebrew name is Mordechai, and Muttal is short for Mordechai.
And when you get into like Yiddish, you know, the Yiddishist world, is there a ceremony where it's like they knight you, like right. You are now Muttal?
Well, if you didn't already have a bris, they have to do that.
Uh-huh.
But fortunately,
he's made man now.
Fortunately, I got that taken care of.
He sang the song about all the pains and the sorrows, and they gave him a Muttal.
Yes, that's
what
right.
What should I be? What should I mark? But wait, you know.
What's your Hebrew name?
You know, I wasn't given one. And when I'm called to the Torah now, I use my grandfather's because he was Walter, but his Hebrew name is Chaim.
Well, Chaim works, but you know, Mark, you, how about a Moshe?
Moshe?
Okay. I think you're a Moshe.
Yeah, maybe Moshe.
Moshe is very smart.
I took a Yiddish class at the Workman Circle and I was Chava Fir because there were four. I was the fourth Chava in the thing.
When I was studying Yiddish at the YIVO, so I also started, by the way, at Workman's Circle. But when I did the YIVO summer course, I was just Muttal, and then there was Reuter Muttal because he had red hair.
Oh. So he was red
Muttal, yeah.
When you met your wife, were you Matthew?
I was transitioning when I met my wife. I met my wife the year after I started studying Yiddish. So she goes back and forth because her brother's name is also Matthew.
Right.
So, or Matt. And so
when you're in trouble, are you Matthew?
if I don't respond the first time, then she goes to Muttal.
See, I was going to say, is your sexy name Muttal or Matthew? But maybe that was a little too personal. I don't know.
There was one porn film made in Yiddish a few years ago. It was a lesbian porn film.
A few years ago?
Yeah. It came out, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago.
It was lesbian porn?
It was a lesbian porn
film. What's
it
called?
In Yiddish. I don't know.
Oh, it must have a great
title. We can think of, yeah.
We have to find that. Yeah. We have to find
it's
the lesbian
porn. I'm not
Yiddish
dead
porn.
Yet.
Bring me back to life.
The oy of sex.
It could always get worse.
We're modest people, so you know, like, you know, you refer to like just like down there, like my Dorten.
Right.
So it's, you know,
could be smaller.
Yeah. Purim's over. What do we do with all the Clementash and bow
Something we asked your castmates when they were here, and I'm curious what the answer is, you know, a few months later. Are you getting any Black Hatters in the audience?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we get super frummies.
Do you?
Yeah, we get little groups of Hasidim who come in sometimes in like twos and threes, you know, that no one else should know that they're there. They kind of sneak off, but yeah.
Yeah, or from older married couples, which is really sweet. We once had a couple of boys with their payas, and I said, how could you listen to a woman singing alone? Aren't you not supposed to do that? But, yeah, but we don't subscribe to this, you know.
They had their own personal. Right. They were rebels. Interesting. The play, how much longer is it going? Indefinitely?
Right now it's announced through August, but you know, it's if people keep coming.
Through 5779.
Jackie Hoffman and Muttal Dittner, thank you so much for being here with us. Our listeners can check out the National Yiddish Theater's production of Fiddler on the Roof at Stage 42.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ashenem Dank.
Ashenem Dank. To the mailbox. First off, I got a special one just for me. Catherine Harris writes with the subject line in the mail, misogyny alert.
How did you know it was for you?
Dear Mark, I love the show, but lose the bitch slap, please. Thank you. I don't remember whom I said needed to be bitch slapped in the last show. Let me begin by saying, that does sound like a term that is, it's a gendered term, right? And I will try not to say bitch slap. However, I was then in the elevator on the way up here today thinking, what term should I substitute for it? I was just like, my mind was going between, you know, as the floors went up. And I thought, well, I'll say pimp slap instead. And then
no,
I thought, well,
that's bad. That's really
that's
bad.
That's much better, Mark.
No, pimp is really bad.
So you don't want bitch slap. You don't want pimp slap. So I thought, well, like, dick slap is like, nope, that's bad. Like
that
all of these.
Why can't altogether. We just slap people?
So then I thought, oh, we'll just talk about slapping people. Well, actually, that's kind of crude as well. Like maybe I just need less violence in my language. But thank you,
and in
Catherine.
Your life,
in all,
less misogyny.
In all seriousness, you're right, and thank you. Another letter. Dear Unorthodox, to follow up on your latest episode, a recent Washington Post column claims, quote, Sephardic and Soviet Jews are not connected to the Holocaust, unquote, as much as European Jews. I've also read the same view several times elsewhere. I am a Jewish immigrant from Russia who is a grandchild of Holocaust survivors. In fact, essentially all Jews from Ukraine, Lithuania, Latvia, etc. are Holocaust survivors. Is this column in the Post reflecting a common misconception, perhaps something that's taught in schools in the United States? Or is it just a few undereducated authors? What's your view of the definition of Holocaust survivors? Thanks, Igor Puck. Well, I went and read that column by Megan McArdle, and it's a bad column. And there's a lot that I think she doesn't understand particularly well, though I generally actually like Megan McArdle's writing a good bit. Certainly Soviet Jews are very connected to the Holocaust.
As are Sephardi Jews.
As are a lot of Sephardi. Right. I mean, there are certainly Jews in the world who aren't as connected to the European death camps as some, right? There's and of course, American Jews whose families got here before the Holocaust, like mine, were not always that connected to the Holocaust, sometimes shamefully disconnected from it. But I think that her generalization is wrong, and thank you for pointing that out. You, however, raise another question, Igor Puck, which is, what's our definition of Holocaust survivor? And this, of course, is a very
touchy
litigated one. Is everyone who was in Europe and didn't die a survivor? What about people who fled into the woods but didn't get taken to the camps? Do you have to have been in a camp to be? I mean,
that is like a dicey, crazy conversation. But yeah, I mean, there's totally different definitions.
What's your definition, Stephanie?
Ooh.
As someone who's descended of survivors.
Look, it's hard because if you were a child, like if you're on the kinder transport, you would still call yourself a Holocaust survivor. But a lot of people would say you actually weren't.
Anyone who might have died and didn't.
I think I'm fine with that. I mean, look, if you fled and escaped, I mean, it was harrowing for everyone. It's hard. But I think there is something specific about having been in the camps that is different. But I don't think that having not been in the camp disqualifies you from the whatever. But it actually comes up a lot in terms of like reparations and this idea of who qualifies for what.
But I mean, then there's a point at which we're all survivors, right? We're Jews and they've been trying to kill us for a while. And
we all, you know, if you've been on the show, but Survivor. Look,
but epigenetics and other, you know, psychological scientific observations tell us that actually people who grew up with parents who'd survived the Holocaust have a very specific set of, you know, emotional, psychological.
My children grew up with a dad whose family had only one chair in the TV room, and we all had to fight
survived.
For it.
And only ate Domino's pizza.
And they ate Domino's pizza 12 nights a week.
I'm
and
a survivor. No, I'm not going to give up.
Igor Puck, thank you for raising a very live question. And I'm sure our listeners have more thoughts. 914-570-4869 or unorthodox at tabletmag.com.
I'm here with Bram Presser. He is the author of The Book of Dirt, which recently won the Jewish Book Council's Award for Debut Fiction. Welcome, Bram.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you're from Melbourne.
Yes.
And I have gotten a window into the Melbourne Jewish community through two of my coworkers, Alyssa Goldstein and Esther Werdiger. You, of course, know both of them.
Of course. It's a small community, but secondly, it's always the way that if you bump into someone and they go, I know someone from Melbourne, you invariably know them.
They've described it as sort of like a shtetl, the Jewish Melbourne scene. I'm just fascinated by it. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
That's a pretty fair call. It's like it's very close knit. It's very geographically confined. There's kind of like one sub. Like my partner's parents have never lived outside of a 4-block radius, including when they were children.
Wow.
I'm an outsider. I come from across town. I've come into the wild west of Jewish Melbourne. But it's lovely. It's very like Hamisher, very kind of we have a very high Holocaust survivor population, so pretty much everyone is a descendant of Holocaust survivors. So it's a very neurotic community, but it's actually gorgeously warm. Like, you know, it's all about the food. We've got great bakeries, great butchers, and I feel like I have to say candlestick makers now. But yeah, it's a good place to live, and it's like a strangely creative Jewish community as well. There's currently this amazing cultural boom coming out of Melbourne, and it's like in every kind of art form, Jewish creativity is exploding, but it's also cutting across into the wider Melbourne community. So there's a very strong Jewish presence in the Melbourne creative world, which is cool.
So your grandparents are survivors, and that is sort of the root of this book. But it takes so many different directions. I don't want to give too much away, but I do want, I think every one of our listeners should read this book because it's just fantastic. I was hoping you actually might be able to read the opening.
Sure.
The opening paragraph, because it's different than the rest of the book. And so maybe it's not the perfect example of the book, but it just drew me in a way that like the opening paragraph doesn't always.
Thanks. I will. I'll preface this by saying I'm going to mispronounce Subcarpathian, which I do every time I read this. In the region of T, not far from the city of U, there once stood a village that had been in Poland, then Hungary, then Subcarpathian Ruthenia, then Czechoslovakia, then Slovakia, then Hungary again, then the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, then the Ukraine, and now cannot be found on any map. This village, satellite to a satellite, changed hands like a crumbling heirloom, each time losing a part of its essence, until one day it ceased to exist. Even its name is forgotten, for nobody is left to lament it. In its place now there might be a field, or forest, although no animal would dare roam there. Or perhaps God, in his infinite wisdom, erased that tract of land, so the world might be smaller and less full of sorrow.
So the thing that struck me, you know, I am the grandchild of survivors, and this idea of, you know, I went to college and I was in a Holocaust course, and the professor told me to stop capitalizing the S in survivor. And this idea that you are raised with, like,
it's a proper noun.
I was like, what do you mean? That's so disrespectful. And that was something that you grew up with, right? Like this idea of like being a tzaddik, like.
Absolutely. So this is like, we lionize and put on pedestals anyone who survived. That it is a given that if you survived, you are a hero. And that is very much the way the Melbourne community sees it as well. Like we are raised in the shadow of the Holocaust to look up with in awe at those who survived. And undoubtedly there's sense in that, but at the same time, it prevents us from ever really looking at the stories and trying to find out the realities of what that life was like. Everyone I know who has survivor grandparents essentially have the same story with slight detail changes around the edges. But beyond that, I don't think they've ever really in depth spoken with their grandparents about what happened. And they don't give, I think, proper agency to those who survived.
It wasn't until after your grandparents died that you were actually able to mine their story. What you expose is fascinating, but it actually, I think it brings you closer to him.
Absolutely. Look, I the whole thing was a kind of accident, I suppose. When they died, I had a version of their survival stories that I was perfectly comfortable with. And it was really just one of those templates. A couple of years after their death, this article was published in the Jewish News in Australia, the Beacon of Australian Jewish Journalism. And it said that my grandfather had been selected by the Nazis to be the literary curator of Hitler's Museum of the Extinct Race. And I naturally was bowled over by this. I was incredibly close to my grandfather when he was alive. And I suddenly had this like epiphany that I didn't really know him at all. And I'd never really thought to, I'm not sure he would have actually told me his story had I asked, but either way, I'd never really thought to ask. And I was 19 when he died. I had plenty of, you know, opportunity, plenty of time. So yeah, I then started looking into the story, and without giving too much away, it took me on some pretty strange twists and turns, and I came out with a story that is not what the newspaper reported, but is very interesting, and I understand how the newspaper came to report what they did. But because I also fictionalized it, and I approached them as my both grandparents as characters who I got to know as people, essentially, I finished the book feeling that I really did know them better than I did when they were alive, and in a really satisfying and warm way as a grandchild who had always revered his grandparents, but then suddenly, you know, that kind of rug's pulled out from under me about the knowledge. I always say it would probably be a bit different if I had found out bad things about them.
Yeah.
Like people always go, you know, what did your family think about this? And I'm like, my family loved it because I found out things that made my grandparents look even better. Mm. That said, I had my mum's cousin called me one day and he's like, I've got a bone to pick with you. I'm like, oh, here we go. I'm like, yeah. He goes, I'm reading the book. It's really good. I really like it. It's a lot. But tell me something. Why did you have to say that your great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, was a drunken gambler? I said, well, to start with, he was. And secondly, because if I didn't really focus on that, people wouldn't realize quite how extraordinary my great-grandmother was. And he said, yeah, I mean, I get that, but that's nobody's business.
And yeah. That sort of seems like you are from this small community. There is a sense of like airing your dirty laundry. Yeah. One thing that I was smiling about was that the story that everyone had told of your grandfather was that he, you know, fled the town that you write about at the beginning of the book, goes to Prague, gets accepted into a wonderful institution, becomes a teacher, and no one actually stopped to like pick any holes in that yeah. story. Like how did he do any of that?
Even in the kind of in the fictional recreation part, that still happens. And it's actually clear that even though like the family story is that he fled this little village and that he was, you know, he got accepted into Charles University and he was taken under the wing of the Jewish community there. Well, clearly he had some sort of introduction, really. Like he couldn't have gone cold and suddenly become this, you know, chosen child of the Czech Jewish community. And he also clearly must have had some sort of education in at the very least Latin to get into law school. So yeah, it's weird, I suppose. And that's actually the nature of family storytelling as well. I don't think you don't tend to pick holes in them. And actually a lot of them probably don't stand up to much scrutiny if you bothered to.
Well, especially, I mean, with the survivor community, because especially as time goes on and those connections are so important to us. And so it almost feels like if you start poking at it.
Well, there's like a heresy to it as well. Like if you like people had to do some terrible things to survive and we never really address that side, right? Because everyone who, and I say that there's a line in the book, you know, every survivor is a saint, right? And I think that we don't necessarily want to dig too much because we're afraid of what we'll find. Like when I set off to write the book or when I set off on the search, like my mum said to me, are you sure you want to do this? Like you don't know what you're going to find and you might find stuff that will change your view of your grandfather and you have to be prepared for that. And I said, actually, I am. She said, well, okay, then do it, but just know, like I don't want to have to tell you I told you so, you know. And thankfully, for the most part, what I found out was good. And also, interestingly, one thing that really keeps coming back to me is there were a couple of things that really troubled him, which were he felt responsible for the death of his best friend or the fact that he survived and his best friend didn't. And also, he felt responsible for his mother's death. And from what I found, there really was no real reason for him to feel that. I wish I could speak with him now and just say to him, this wasn't your fault. You know, this wasn't, you should be able, your conscience should be able to rest easy because you didn't cause your mother to die. You know, your best friend, like circumstance killed your best friend and luck spared you. You know, he felt a lot greater responsibility in those things.
I think you're definitely right that there is this blasphemy of uncovering. It's true, like to survive, you had to, you were either in the right place at the right time,
yep.
Your number wasn't called, or you had to,
you did something at the expense of someone else.
And I think if we were more open to exploring that or acknowledging that, I imagine it would help us because the trauma that these people lived their entire life with. You have a beautiful line that he was like haunted by, you know, even he escaped, moved continents, but still was like haunted by this his whole life. I imagine that is what makes their suffering so great years and years later.
I think you're right. I think had they been able to speak about it, had they been able to actually explore it a bit more, it probably would have been incredibly therapeutic. That said, I absolutely understand why you want to lock the trauma away and just mentalize it in your life and just say, I'm walking away. This terrible thing happened. I'm never revisiting it again. Like to open even slightly I think I say it in the book, is like to open a Pandora's box and all of the, everything comes out. And so better to just focus on this great life I've made for myself in my case, Australia. And that will be the defining part of my life, not my 5 years or 6 years in under Nazism.
I was lucky enough to meet you because you won an award at the National Jewish Book Awards, where I was emceeing the night.
Host.
Yeah.
All the good gags.
Yeah, all the, you know, those Elie Wiesel zingers. Yeah. definitely the right crowd for that. But there was a very funny moment in the middle of the awards.
Is this when I dropped the chair?
No, I didn't even notice that. Did you drop a chair?
Yeah, as I stood up when you like called my name, I like stood up and knocked the chair back in classic Bram fashion, then tripped over it trying to pick it up.
No.
I'm surprised I didn't like sweep my arm across and spill water across
the lady next to me.
Yeah.
The tablecloth. No, it was very funny because it was a, you know, very fancy dinner.
Yeah.
A lot of well-heeled folks there.
Yes.
And there was a moment where I bumped into someone. And it was you. And we both, without realizing who it was, we were like, sorry, sorry, sorry. And then we turn around and saw each other.
I was like, oh, sorry.
I was like, oh, it's just you.
Yeah, that moment I thought, they're going to take the award away. This is going to be like the person who's the chief patron or something like that.
But I am curious because you look a little different than all the other people who were there. You have tattoos.
I was the Manishtana of
you the- You have piercings, dreadlocks. I mean, I'm wondering,
no suit.
No. Oh, were you not wearing a suit?
No.
I didn't notice anything. I missed the chair.
I put on my finest dirty t-shirt and jeans and
that's
didn't
good.
Notice.
You got to stay. You got to like, you know, you have your image and you need to really lean into it.
But yeah, like, look, it's kind of weird being there as the, like, because my background is in punk and I'm still really just like a punk now who writes. So it's kind of funny being the odd one. But like, you know, I'm the odd one out in Melbourne as well. So it's like, it's just transposing it across to a slightly fancier context. Yeah.
Because you actually are really a foundational part of the Jewish punk scene, right? In Melbourne with your band, Yidkor?
Apparently so. Like, well, in Melbourne, certainly, because like there wasn't, I'm told that there was kind of a Jewish punk like first generation in the 80s or something, but we were part of the kind of, I think it's the, you would call it the Jewish punk renaissance of the late 90s, early 2000s. And there's a book by Michael Kroll and Oi 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 Gewalt, and then he's got the punk rock horror follow up, and it's very strange because a lot of it is about Yidkor, and it's really weird reading about yourself in like a kind of, like, we were just, you know, a bunch of schmucks who ran around the world smearing ourselves with hummus and screaming into rubber chickens and stuff like that. And he's writing this like very, you know, quite erudite, serious piece on the world of Jewish punk in kind of a cultural context and in an intellectual way. And I'm like going, that's pretty funny for my joke, like to end up here. But it's cool. Like it's amazing. And like, Yidkor had a really great life and it's good fun. And it's a, currently the worst kept secret that we're getting back together for one show at the end of this year.
Wow.
For a big Jewish music festival in Australia.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which should be cool fun.
So you play punk shofar.
Yes.
Can you describe that to me?
It is equal parts what goes out and what goes in. So in the what goes out front, it's just, you know, played at various times with a band and during songs, and, you know, it goes through the usual, you know, tekiya, Shvarim, Trua stuff, but as well as just random noises. As far as what goes in, that's a whole other story. So we used to do shots, like we'd get people up from the audience and they'd put one side in their mouth and we'd pour usually kiddish wine or chicken soup down for people to do shots. And the funniest thing about it, though, is I don't know if you've ever tasted anything that's come through a shofar. It's disgusting because it actually still has sort of rancid meat kind of at the end, right?
Oh, gross.
Yeah,
I was just thinking it has a lot of like spit in there.
Well, that's probably, that's the least of the worries actually, but like-
It's sanitizing.
Yeah, exactly. That's
that is gross.
Yeah, it is. And like, I'd never do it, but I got countless other people to do it. Like, which
and
is
you would
weird.
Be like put your shofar in their mouth and then
yes.
It was basically like a beer bong.
And that's exactly what it was.
But you know, a sacred ritual object.
So I'm told, yes. And like my shofar, and I actually dug it out the other day. It's one of those long ones, and it's got like, I used to, when we were touring, I used to put it on, like pack it in the, what do you call it, freight, like in the oversized luggage and all that. And so it's got all like country stickers on it and like, you know, punk stickers on it. It's the best decorated shofar in town. But at the same time, I also used to take that shofar and I blew it in some synagogues and all that. So like it was properly ritually used as well. So I like to think that I, you know, on balance, I've kind of got away with it.
I love the idea of like expanding the use of the shofar instead of it just being like something you dig out twice a year.
Massively underused. Yeah. Also, I think it's got a really great sound. And look, I'm instrumentally challenged is I think the technical term. So to be able to play an instrument and be half decent at it and people go, what the hell even is that? Is fantastic. And also at punk shows, I don't think people expect someone to pull out a, you know, 4-foot ram's horn and start A, making noises out of it, and B, forcing people to drink disgusting liquids through it.
It's like very retro when you pull that out.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, okay, this goes well beyond 1970 when punk started. This is like, you know, 1970 BC.
So did you learn to play shofar when you were younger, or was this this?
No, I sort of just taught myself. Yeah. And what's weird with the piercings is, I mean, I'm down to 2 piercings, but I used to have a
lot
more.
Can you describe them? Is there a name for lip
piercings? Okay. I suppose they're in my bottom lip. You know, that I used to have a lot more. I used to have about 12 on my head. So nose. The only thing I didn't pierce was my ears because I was scared of how much apparently it hurts.
That's
which is
insane.
Really weird, right?
It hurts more than everything else on your face?
Well, I've got no idea, but I just had in my head growing up because I'd always wanted to get piercings. And my parents were like, no, it really hurts to pierce your ears.
You're like, I'll pierce everything else.
Yeah, and then I come back with like everything else pierced and covered in tattoos, but no ear piercings.
Wow.
But yeah, so as I had, I used to have 4 lip piercings. And like when I got to that point, it actually became hard to play the shofar because like, you can't get the seal right.
Yeah. Like, that's not how God intended the shofar to be played.
That's right. He bram-proofed it.
Bram Presser, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been great fun.
If our listeners want to follow along with your journeys, how can they find you, buy your book, et cetera?
So the book's available, you know, at the usual online sites and in hopefully as many bookstores as we'll stock it. And then brampresser.com. And my Twitter is just at Bram Presser. I have I Am Instabram, which I basically joined Instagram just so I could make the pun. And I'm really terrible at updating it. And then I've also got a Facebook. But basically, I am not hard to find.
All right. The Book of Dirt, which everyone should read. Thank you so much, Bram.
Thank you.
So Mazel Tovs. First, I want to go to the voicemail box. I'm going to turn my Mazel Tov opportunity, my Mazel Tunity over to the listeners. Have a listen.
Hi, J. Crew. This is Elite Braswell from Orange County, California, by way of Texas. I want to give a huge Mazel Tov to my husband, Scott Braswell, who was just named the executive director of the Mirage JCC of Orange County. Since we're Californians now, I like to refer to him as the Sean McVay of JCCs. And I couldn't be more proud of him for all that he's accomplished.
Liel, have you a Mazel Tov?
I do. I would like to tell David Cohen, our listener David Cohen, I would like to wish him a very happy anniversary from his wonderful wife, the lovely Emily Cohen, and to remind him that he's very lucky to have her in his life, even though she sent us a note saying how lucky she was to have him in her life. So, once again, we did this last year. We're happy and proud to do it this year. A very happy anniversary for Emily and David Cohen.
Sort of an annual tradition.
Yeah. Speaking of Cohens.
We love you guys.
I got to shout out Ben Cohen, my husband. It was his birthday this weekend and, you know.
Mazel Tov and Siman Tov.
Mazel Tov on making it another year.
The problem I'm about like 6 months older than he is. And so from the period between his birthday and my birthday, we are the same calendar age.
I do not like that. No, that won't do at all.
So September better get here soon.
Unorthodox brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. We want your mail at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or at 914-570-4869 for voicemail. Our newsletter can be subscribed to at bit.ly/unorthodoxpodcast. To book us live or advertise with us, go to Josh Cross, that's JKROSS, @tabletmag.com. Send him an email. Tell him how he can serve you. Follow us on Instagram @unorthodoxpodcast or Twitter @unorthodox_pod. Join our Facebook group. Our show is produced by Josh Cross. Our associate producers are Sarah Fredman, Ader, and Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media mashkiach is Elazar Abrams. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision by Rabbi Jill Levy, who takes over as the director of the day camp of the Camp Ramah Systems in Greater Washington, D.C. She replaces Rabbi Rami Schwartzer. She inherits the Rabbi Rami Schwartzer chair in Ramah Day Camp leadership. And we come to you from Argo Studios, which is still trying to decide which summer camp to send its Jewish children to this summer. Shalom, friends.